Hello and welcome to Open Mind Radio. This is your host Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by Martin Antiquer Willis.
Hello, Antiquer. Yes, I'm a rare breed. That's even rarer than a UFO quote unquote expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I don't know about that actually. There's lots of antiquers out there.
Yeah, not so much. It's really, as far as young people go, hardly people like IKEA these days.
And, yeah.
But I love, the beautiful workmanship and stuff and antiques and artwork and all that. So, yes, I'm guilty as charged.
Yeah, I appreciate that stuff. I guess I don't have the know-how or really the patience to go out and hunt it down. I can see myself doing that when I'm older. So I'm kind of part of the IKEA crowd, but I love the contemporary looks just because, and I don't know if I've told the audience this yet, that I am doing real estate.
Oh,
yeah,
that's right.
I am a real estate agent now, so I can help you buy a home or sell it in the Phoenix metro area. So get a hold of me and check out EastValleyProperty.com. There's a little plug for my real estate. So I do a lot of, I spend a lot of time, like that site, I'm tweeting real estate, I'm out there looking at houses. And a lot of people have kind of a look, and it's kind of a nice look, but I really gravitate towards the contemporary, because not a lot of people are brave enough to go there. But when it's done well, it's a lot of fun, and I think that's kind of what people, younger crowds, look towards. But I gotta say, I love the old stuff. There is a house. We did an open house in Fountain Hills out here a few weeks ago, and this house, I called it the Nixon Desert Hideout, because that's what it felt like. It felt like walking into the Nixon era. This house was built in 77, and everything was just like it was in 1977. I think it's original appliances. I never even heard of this company, Caloric. You might like this. A Caloric oven.
Yes.
And it was spotless. It looks brand new, but it's all the old dials and everything, with mm-hmm. Back to the Future being in the news so much. It felt like stepping into the past. This house is absolutely amazing. And the sad thing is nobody wants it because it's old, even though it's like, it feels upscale 70s, like mm-hmm. Nixon's house. Nobody wants that. So unfortunately, someone's probably going to come and take all that out and make it all contemporary and everything, which is, it's on a hill. So it'll be amazing and awesome if someone does that. But, I have an appreciation for that sort of stuff. So I guess I can see your point, though, that especially the younger crowd are not as into it.
Well, like you said, I like to mix and match myself as far as, decorating a home. But the simplicity when it comes to contemporary looks really nice. But mm-hmm. Here we're talking about UFOs, so I think we're gotten us a little bit off topic, possibly.
Hey, this is my show, buddy.
All right.
And so we
can
talk
what you
about,
want.
Yeah, because I do want to say one more thing, actually, because, you're an expert. This is what you do. This is gold, people. If they don't like it, oh, well. But and I think it kind of pertains to UFOs as well, is that it's almost like these days, the problem is we know too much about history. It used to be, especially before the internet, your history books or other mm-hmm. things would tell you about history, and history was whitewashed, kind of. And nowadays, we know all the dirty laundry. So, like, when we see a Nixon-era house, we're thinking of, like, Godfather. And, you know, Nixon with his deals and, oh, we're going to get those guys and sick the IRS on them. And, you know, all of this bad, evil stuff. Or even when you look at older Victorian or something like that, you know, you think of the beheadings and all of this crazy stuff that had gone on. So it's kind of like we look at history and think of the bad stuff almost more these days.
Right, right. Yeah. Watergate with the Nixon era, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, shows like Mad Men, you know, stuff that there's really people that are really into, you know, because of, you know, to decorate like that fun stuff.
Yeah. And I say it pertains to UFOs because so much of the UFO stuff is, I mean, the golden era of material. And I talked about this with Robert Powell, who was my guest last week, and is from the 50s and 60s, because that's when the Air Force was openly studying. I mean, it was more of a serious topic in the mainstream back then than it, and it's starting to come back to that, I feel, at least when it comes to the media, not so much the government, but... So we had this heyday of UFO history, and it's kind of like, you know, that's one of the things I like to do a lot. Sometimes people, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this. A lot of people are saying, why are we, you know, spending all of our time on this old stuff? Why aren't we looking at new stuff? And for me, it's partially, I don't want to forget those days. I think a lot of people don't know about them, and that history will get forgotten if we don't keep reviewing it, especially because the mainstream could care less about it.
Well, I agree with you, and in some ways you have to look at it this way too, is, you know, even though, for instance, Roswell has, there's a lot of myth about Roswell that's, you know, it's kind of carried on its own, created its own little monster, but there's still some really interesting things. There's still a few witnesses left, not too many. But, you know, there are many, many cases, Socorro, you know, on and on and on, that are really substantial. And speaking of all, like, this historic stuff, I was contacted by a woman just yesterday, and she told me that a sighting that I talked about in Monterey when I had it, Carmel Valley, that 40 miles away she had her sighting 77 years ago.
Wow.
So I'm just getting a little correspondence back and forth with her to find out exactly what that is, but interesting. 77 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing. And that just brings to mind, too, just because I watched Bridges of Spies this weekend, which is a great movie with Tom Hanks. It's directed and created by, I think, Steven Spielberg, about the Cold War, and really great stuff. But it brings to mind another movie that's going to have a lot of history, UFO history, that I'm really excited about, especially talking about this, is the Betty and Barney Hill movie that Bryce Zabel is helping to produce, and it's gotten bought up by a large production company, and it's going to happen, it seems like. So that's really exciting. And knowing Bryce, you know, and it even seems like, and some people seem too frustrated about this, but it's really going to be a time period piece where he's going to, you know, juxtapose the Betty and Barney Hill along with the times, what was going on during that time. And I think that's important because the politics, especially of a mixed race couple like Betty and Barney Hill were, and then claiming these extraterrestrial experiences, I think it's going to be a great movie. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, I think that's important too. And which brings me back to, I had Michael Shermer on, skeptic Michael Shermer on last week. And one of the things he said, now, why did Roswell, we're talking about that earlier, but why did Roswell happen in 1947 and stay quiet all those years? And there was a report that came out in the 60s, what was the most, you know, the largest cases of the late 40s and early 50s. And out of 600 cases, Roswell didn't even come up. And I said, and then it came out in the late, you know, 1970s, early 1980s, basically whenever that happened. And I said, well, there's a reason for that. There's a reason why you do talk about what's going on historically. you know, we had just finished the war. We won the war. People really respected the government. When the government said to you, don't you talk about this, you're going to listen. And that's, you know, you always have to look at things in the perspective of when they happened and what was going on.
Yeah.
I agree with that 100%.
That's a really great point. And a lot of people don't realize, because I talked to Jesse Marcel Jr., who I knew very well. I did his website and all this other stuff. And he, what was interesting to me, and I didn't even get till I talked to him, was right along the lines of what you're talking about. His dad, they portray his dad as being upset. You know, his Jesse Marcel's dad was the first one, the Air Force intelligence officer to look at the material. He was the guy that said, this is something weird, this is not a balloon, and everybody agreed with him, and that's how it all happened. And then later his dad was told, hey, it's a balloon, tell everybody it's a balloon, end of story. His dad was not distraught by that. He wasn't upset when it happened. He said, yes, sir, he was a good soldier. He, mm-hmm. You know, it was after the war. He didn't question his bosses. He decided, this is what we need to do. This is my, these are my orders. I'm doing it.
Right. And that's how you did everything then.
Yeah. It was like, I trust it, and I'm going to do what I'm told. And so mm-hmm. exactly, you have to look at it from the lens of that time period. And you know what? And this highlights something else with Shermer that is just aggravating. Shermer should know this. If he's going to come and debate Roswell, he should know the history of Roswell. And obviously there's an indication that he does not know the history of Roswell. So he is completely uneducated, and he's wanting to debate a topic he's completely uneducated about. That is so frustrating.
Well, wait till, you know, I don't know if you're going to get a chance to listen to it, but wait till you hear him talk about the Phoenix Lights.
That's really
yeah.
aggravating.
It was really aggravating. And then I kept saying, you know, it was one part in the show where I just said, you know, I totally disagree. Disagree.
Yeah. That's what's hard, is that I don't think I'd be able to interview. How could you interview Shermer? You get to a point where, well, you know what? I think we have to end this phone call, because until you go get educated on these topics, we can't really even speak to him.
Right.
What are we going to do?
A lot of proclamations. And there was someone that that wrote me an email just after and said that he needed to be kicked in a certain area many times.
Ooh, ouch. Yeah. Well, there was in Vegas, I saw this guy. He had a sign on him, and I think we caught him just after he did this. He had a sign that said, $20 and you can kick me in the groin. So he was going around, you know, and I think people were paying $20, you know, these ornery people. I wouldn't want to do that to anybody, not even Shermer.
No kidding.
But these guys are like, yeah, here's $20, man, and they're kicking him. So, yeah,
oh,
maybe
my.
One day Shermer will have a career doing that, and then he can make a lot of money.
It's pretty bizarre. Yeah, people standing in line, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, maybe we should do that at the next UFO Congress. We'll invite Michael Shermer to come, and he can make a ton of money letting people do that.
Good idea.
That would be good. All right, but where I digress. Let's the guest for today, and we're late again. This show is actually airing on Tuesday because our guest, you know, is a busy man, and we've had to delay a bit. So we're going to have Mark Rodiger. We're going to talk to him about his past with UFOs and how he got into all of this, because he's the head of QFOS, the Center of UFO Science, Center for UFO Studies.
Studies, not science, Science, close enough.
Science-minded organization. I just screwed that up. But it was started by J. Allen Hynek, who was the astronomer, who was a consultant to the U.S. Air Force from like 51 to 69. The entire time they did UFO investigations, once those ended, you know, Hynek was still involved with UFOs, because even though he started as a skeptic, by the end of consulting for the Air Force, he believed there was a real phenomena, and he wanted scientific study of this phenomena, so he started QFOS, and Mark Rodiger is still the head of QFOS today. And so we're going to talk
great
to him.
Great guy.
Yeah, great guy, a scientist. We're going to talk to him about that, how he got involved, his history there. And then we're also going to talk about this new project that he is involved with called UFO Data. And I believe you did interview Leslie and Mark.
That's
recently.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, so...
Mark's a sharp guy. You'll get a lot out of it. Great interview. I can't wait to listen because they were on too short. You know, you're going to have them on for however long you have them on, an hour or more probably. But they just had a short time, short window to be on. So I'm very interested in hearing this interview today.
Well, you know, what was funny is I decided just to do him by himself because I know he's got so much interesting to say. I've known him and talked with him for years now, actually, but I've never had him on the show, and it's one of those things where I figured he was just too busy. I didn't want to take up his time. He's a busy, serious-minded person, and so I decided, you know, I've always wanted to talk to him some more. I've just always been very impressed with him. He's certainly kind of one of my heroes in this field, so I'm really excited to talk to him about it, all this.
Great.
All right, but before we do that, why don't we get into the news, and why don't you start us off?
Sure. We have a massive UFO drops only to 10 feet above the head of an Omaha witness.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Now, this happened back in October, the first week of October, October 4th, and it was around 8:20. It was just dusk, and this gentleman was out on his third-floor deck when he saw a cloud. There was no wind, according to him. He saw a cloud moving closer toward him, and as it moved toward him, it turned into a boomerang shape, and then it was sort of like a grayish color, and it looked like an object that flew over only about 10 feet above him, steady, and as he saw it go over the treetops, it kind of flew away, turned white, I think it was, and actually changed form. It seems like a really odd UFO sighting. It had a little bit of a noise. It sounded like the wind. I'm not really sure what this one gets investigated more so they can figure it out or try to figure it out. Well, one thing he did I thought was very good is he didn't want to think about anything else. He just ran right in and drew what he saw quickly on a piece of paper, and it does look like a boomerang, sort of. So that's good, and like I said, I hope someone really checks this out and does more investigation on it.
Yeah, although that's hard to do with anecdotal stuff, but what's interesting here again is, like you say, boomerang, but it is like a boomerang that comes to a point. So kind of a triangular, pretty much shaped craft, and there's all these triangular craft these days. I talked to Robert about that. I've talked to Roger Marsh about that, who wrote this story and has been writing the MUFON stories. Such an abundance of triangular craft being seen. It's so interesting.
Right.
I'm sure there are some dialogues. I don't pay attention too much to the channeling. I'm sure, you know, some people are saying the Arcturians have come and ran the grays out of the solar system or trying to or something, and, you know, they're in their triangles chasing the saucers. I don't know. But it's almost like, you know, you could – I mean, what's going on?
I know. You know, it's like the new model of UFO is the triangle. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird that it morphed. And, you know, basically when I'm saying research, I'm just wondering if there's any other witnesses at all or if he's the sole witness.
Right, yeah.
And if he's the sole witness, you're right. It's kind of a dead end.
Yeah. And it is hard. Yeah, it's interesting. And some people are saying that the triangles are all human-made.
I've heard that a lot, too.
Perhaps some more recent ones are, and perhaps that's what's going on. Who knows? But it's really interesting. There's so many sightings, especially because of the extraordinary abilities that people see these things, you know, do.
Yeah, and just generally that they're no sound at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, if the government has made something like this, it would have to be like anti-gravity and who knows what type of propulsion. And how could the secret, I don't know. And the one thing that really stumbles each and every time someone says, you know, these are military or whatever, is why would they fly them over the areas they fly them over, if that's so?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, be one thing on a test site, but over, you know, busy cities and Chicago or wherever, you know, it just doesn't make any sense where those things would be flown, where they're seen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another, you know, one of these triangular craft sightings. An exciting one, I think, is in a story that I posted on Friday from Norio Hayakawa. I really loved Norio. He's a really cool guy. Some people get frustrated by him because he's very skeptical about many things, even Roswell. However, he's really into this topic. And what I loved about this story, it's actually something he posted on his site, and he allowed me to repost on our site. It's called Amazing First-Hand Testimonials from Dulce, New Mexico Families. Because, like Norio and I have looked into Dulce, so have others. I've been there. I've lived in Colorado, which is Dulce, New Mexico is right on the border. There's so many rumors of an alien base or a underground base there. I'm highly, highly skeptical of this, just having been to the area and looked into this for years. These rumors start from Doty, who people who listen to the show know, is a guy who said he spread disinformation, and this was one of his, he even claims, disinformation stories. But there are still a lot of weird stories from that area. And so although Norio's skeptical, he wrote a story about these, you know, cool UFO stories from the area, and they are really interesting. Now, the area is essentially just south of the San Luis Valley, which is Chris O'Brien researches the San Luis Valley.
Right.
That's where I had my first sighting. I've spent a lot of time there. I used to camp out there all the time. And that's had a history of really crazy stuff going on and lots of UFO sightings. So it's a really mysterious area. And that whole area is the ground zero for cattle mutilations. I mean, San Luis Valley is where the first one happened. And in the 70s, there were a ton of them out there, and the FBI even went out there and researched them and everything. So lots of strange stuff happening in that area, but it's a really cool story people should check out.
Right.
The other question, did you see the video from Oklahoma that we posted?
No, sir, I have not.
Yeah, well, this is Oklahoma, and this video was taken on July 8th, 2015, 4:30 p.m., so it's a daytime sighting. This guy said he saw something with his binoculars. It got closer. He pulled out his iPhone and was able to take a short video. But he said it moved strangely. He said it was shaped like Cloud City on Star Wars. And it was marked as an unknown just because it looks like it might be a kite, though. But they just, this person seeming didn't feel that it was. He thought maybe it was something larger. But you have to check out the video. I mean, it does look like it could be a tight kite that was broken loose and is floating around up there. But that's the UFO video for the past week.
Uh-huh. I'm looking at the image of it right now, and I can see why you're talking about possible kite. Almost looks like it has a tail as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess they just feel that, you know, it was really high. They think it was at like 1,500 feet, and so something wouldn't be that high. And although you can't tell it in the video, I guess they feel that maybe it moved strangely, unlike a kite. But from the video, at least you can't, at least the video alone, you can't rule out a kite, I guess.
Yeah. I actually just did watch the video as we talk here, and it doesn't look like it's moving. I can't see that it's moving.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, it doesn't look like it's moving.
Yeah,
but
so
if it's really
far
away,
it could be a stationary
away,
kite.
Yeah. Although, like, yeah. Yep.
It does look pretty high up in the air, but anyway.
But that could be deceiving.
That's true. It's awful hard to tell because you can't see anything on the ground.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So hard to know.
Right.
All right, well, there's the news. Otherwise, you know, we talked about some of the most exciting stuff on our last UFO report just posted on Friday, we talk about a lot of exciting news. We talk about the CIA in Area 51, where they did this panel on Area 51. And Jeremy Corbell, the filmmaker, asked them about UFOs. You guys should go check out, because Jeremy Corbell, and I put it in our story, if you come check out our story on it, Jeremy Corbell videotaped his questioning about UFOs, and he put it on his website. And so you can see that in our story as well. And we interviewed him for the UFO report. So we have an interview with him in the UFO report on that. And then we also do review some information about the UFO, about some other stuff going on, including the story with, you know, the light dimming in and out and stuff like that, and other cool stuff. So, yeah, check out the last UFO report for some of that. And all of these stories are on openminds.tv.
Great.
So who do you have coming up this week?
I have Kevin Randall coming up.
Okay. And are you going to have me on the show doing news with you?
Of course you'll be on the show.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Because I'm sure you took a major dip in listenership.
I did. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Great show. No
don't
me.
Email. Uh-huh.
Michael Shermer instead of me.
Well, no, it was a little more complicated than that.
I know. I'm just kidding. No, but I missed you. So it'll be great to talk again some more, and we'll see what news happens between now and then, huh?
That's right. Yeah, hopefully something.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. There's always something going on in this field.
That's right.
There really is.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll talk to you in a couple days then.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Is this the
yeah, doing that again. That's just too fun to do.
You know I do awkward well.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. Thanks, man. We will talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk to Mark. I am very happy to be joined by Mark Rodiger. Hello.
Hi, Alejandro, and I'm very glad to be here.
Well, this is actually pretty exciting for me, because you may not know it, but I've had great respect for you and KUFOS for many years. I know we've been able to talk maybe a couple of times, and you might not have noticed. I was a little intimidated, so this is really exciting for me.
Well, I'm glad to finally do a podcast with you and talk about many things UFO.
Yeah, so we'll get into UFO data, which is really exciting, because it's forward looking into taking the next step in the research of this topic. However, you're associated with some of the most important UFO history, which is KUFOS and J. Allen Hynek. So maybe if you could talk about Hynek and the beginning of KUFOS.
You know, it's interesting when you put it that way, Alejandro. I haven't thought about it much because I'd like to think I don't, you know, I'm a modest guy. But as we know, Allen Hynek was there at the start of the modern UFO era, assisting the Air Force in Project Sign, the first UFO project, to analyze cases and, of course, in his case, pretty much try to explain things away, as he admitted later. And he continued on for many years until 1969 as their consultant, with a little gap there in the late 40s, early 50s. Then he started the center. I'll get to that in a second. But continuing on, I then inherited the mantle of the scientific director of the center and have been doing it since 1986. And so there is, in that sense, a continuous line in UFO history of Allen Hynek through me until today.
Mm-hmm.
The center was founded in 1973 by Allen, and it was founded because there was a huge wave of sightings in the U.S. in the fall of 73, which I'm sure many people listening know about. It was the last major wave of UFO sightings, and he realized that, or at least he thought, it wasn't being well investigated. But not only that, he'd been thinking for quite some time about founding his own group, and so that was the impetus for him to do so. Of course, he wanted the center to be more like a think tank rather than a, I'll call it a standard UFO organization. He respected groups like MUFON, APRO then, and so forth, for what they did, but he wanted to have more of an academic, scientific approach.
Which is great. And you know, a lot of people, like, for instance, when I interviewed Seth Shostak, one of the things he asked me, which was kind of funny because it was kind of off topic, and I've seen him and others do this before. He said, well, if, you know, there was something to this phenomena, astronomers would be involved. And my argument, especially in looking at Hynek, is astronomers are the ones who started contemporary kind of UFO investigation.
Yes, at least in part with Alan. Of course, Jacques Vallée was trained in astronomy in France and came over to work with Alan in the mid-60s and became part of the what he called the Invisible College, when academics and professionals had to hide somewhat their interest in the subject. But, you know, skeptics or debunkers, call them what you wish, like Seth Shostak, Michael Shermer, and so forth, you know, they make many claims that, that may or may not sound plausible on face reading. But, in fact, if one understands the history of science, the sociology of science, and so forth, they turn out not to have much force in terms of explaining away the UFO phenomena or explaining away scientific interest in it.
Now, when it comes to some of the mainstream scientists like Shostak who try to explain it away, you know, coming from an academic perspective, how do you, or perhaps maybe you do it the same way Hynek did, but how do you justify then the investigation or research into the UFO phenomena?
It turns out that for me personally, and I think also, you know, just taking a broader perspective for the field, It's extremely easy to justify studying UFOs, putting aside whatever theory one may have or hypothesis about what their origin is or are, depending on if you want to make it plural. I got interested in the subject as a young guy in the 60s because of all the UFO sightings that were happening and that were quite exciting, and started out reading the sensational books and then graduated the more serious ones. But I didn't get interested because I had a sighting, which many people in the field have had, and that kind of spurred them on. I didn't. I got interested in the same way I'd like to think that I was also interested in astronomy and physics as a young guy. And that is that I found it to be incredibly intriguing and fascinating and worthy of study. Now, the worthy of study part is the aspect of it that that justifies when I said, you know, it's easy to say that that this subject is reasonable to study, because anything in the world is reasonable to study. There's not one thing hardly we can think of that isn't worth studying at some level. The only question is, can we study it scientifically? And, you know, obviously we should study it scientifically if it's a scientific topic, but can we study it scientifically? Because it may be very difficult to do for a variety of reasons. But, you know, is it plausible, is it reasonable to study the fact that people say they have UFO sightings? Obviously, it's reasonable because we study all kinds of things about the world that are far less interesting, in my judgment, even though, fine, forever, you know, it's a free world that people can do what they want. So, you know, of course there should be some people investigating UFO sightings and then taking a broader perspective, looking at the data as a whole and saying, okay, these are the patterns we see, and, you know, this theory is more suited to the data, this theory is less suited to the data, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So how do you go about then, and I know this is going to get to later on other things we're looking at, but largely this phenomena is anecdotal. Can you scientifically investigate anecdotal information?
I'll return to what I said a second ago, which is you can study just about anything scientifically, but it may be difficult to do so. And a parallel to that is not meteor sightings. We've used that for a long time, but ball lightning sightings. For many, many years, scientists, meaning physicists and so forth, doubted even the existence of ball lightning, which, in case people listening don't know, is not really lightning, even though it seems to appear during thunderstorms usually, but it is a glowing ball of hot gases, I'm sure, fairly small, often with a lot of energy packed in that small volume, and seen for brief, very brief periods of time. Well, seen for brief periods of time, nobody was taking photos of it, doesn't leave many traces, therefore the evidence was anecdotal. And in fact, mostly still is, except for a very few photos and other measurements. That eventually did not deter some brave and hardy scientists from saying, you know, I'm going to take these reports seriously, and I'm going to try to develop a physical theory that will explain it. Mm-hmm. So you can do it, but, you know, because you can't bring it in the lab, it's not easy to do, and you can't necessarily verify your theory, test your theory. And so science eventually has to, as a Popper, a philosopher of science, said, you have to find a way to test your theory. So, in fact, you can't really prove a theory to be true, but you can prove it to be false. Mm-hmm. That's the standard line, and I generally agree with that. In UFOs, we have the anecdotal evidence, as you said. Almost all of it is. I think it's very powerful evidence. There's no reason why anecdotal evidence can't be quite strong. Like anything in life, most of life dealing day-to-day stuff is often anecdotal. Somebody said this to this person, you know, this, that, whatever. You know, I wasn't there to witness it. Can we, for example, do a test of the UFO data and show and falsify the hypothesis that some UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft or some UFOs are time travelers or et cetera? And the answer is no, we can't. But it doesn't mean the subject's not scientific. It means it is just a difficult scientific subject.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to that, and hopefully I don't forget. But I did want to ask you, regarding the ball lightning, I think that's a great example because it seems as though, especially more lately, that the existence of ball lightning is fairly well accepted in mainstream scientific circles, although it is something that is anecdotal.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of things that we can think of that are anecdotal. I won't, you know, bore us, the listeners, with long list of things here, but it won't take long for anybody, if they just think about science in general, that either it is anecdotal, witness testimony, or it's just very difficult to sort out. Mm-hmm. You know, here's an example of something that's difficult to sort out. You know, lots of scientists study human origin, and they go to Africa and a few other places, and Africa, you know, because that's where, of course, the human race originated. And they dig up old fossils, you know, with human bones. You know, we don't think of them as fossils as such. We think of that more dinosaurs, but they're fossils of humans. And they're 3 million years old. They're 2 million years old and so forth. Well, they'll find a small part of a skeleton or two, and they'll try to infer on the basis of that and some other characteristics like the time it was and all that, you know, something about that that early human, that hominid that existed then. Tremendous acrimony and debate goes on in the paleoanthropology community about this. And you can read about some of it, because they basically have not a lot of data. It's not anecdotal, right? They're actually holding the bone fragment, but it's just a bone fragment. And so you can't infer much from it. So there are lots of ways where evidence is ambiguous, and it's certainly ambiguous often in ufology, though I don't think it's ambiguous about the existence of a UFO phenomenon and some of its characteristics. What is ambiguous, of course, is the ultimate origin and some of the, you know, more key central things we would like to know about the subject, some of, you know, the key characteristics of the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, and getting back to the ball lightning, or in this case, the ambiguous information, and what you mentioned before is that the nature of the phenomena, and it's something Vallée and Hynek, some people were frustrated about, but they made the argument that, which I think is a very valid argument, and I think has to be repeated often, is we don't know. We've got an observed phenomena here, or an anecdotal phenomena, And that doesn't necessarily give us, we can't say for sure the nature of that phenomena. And it could be any number of things or something that we can't even comprehend.
That's absolutely true. You know, the universe is a giant place. It seems to be getting bigger by the moment. First of all, space is expanding, so of course it actually is getting bigger by the moment. But I mean, in terms of our discoveries and so forth, and there has to be far more we don't know about the world and the universe than we do know, because science is still, you know, what, 400, 500 years of true modern type science, let's hope the human race lasts, let's say a million years. So if even, you know, whatever we do, if we continue doing some type of science, then all we have so far is 500 out of a million years of science. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to just propose that we are going to continue to learn things. And we're also going to get more technologically powerful, and we'll build robots that act like humans. And that, you know, that's related to science, but that will be for another podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So, because of that, I am always very cautious to theorize too much about the origin of UFOs. We not only can we think of what they could be, and again, time travelers, parallel universes, you know, projections of the human mind, right? There are people that have said, well, they're real, but they're projections of the human mind that are actually physically, they exist for those few minutes during a sight, and then they vanish. And then you can go on and, you know, add your next favorite theory to that, and then things that we can't even imagine yet.
Mm-hmm.
And since we can't easily test those things, though, of course, with UFO data, which we'll get to, we're trying to at least pull the curtain a little further back. I have spent my time in the field, just trying to do what we can to look at some of the better data and see what, like I said, what patterns are there, because science fundamentally is a pattern finding and then pattern explaining activity. You know, first you find the thing you want to explain, and you and if it just appears once and never appears again, you aren't going to be able to explain it. And then after you've got that thing and you see what its patterns and characteristics are, you come up with ideas, hypotheses, and theories to explain it. And then, of course, you test it, and there's a circle, where you go back and revise and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what science is, and that's what, you know, ultimately we'd like to do in UFO research.
Mm-hmm. Now, what Hynek was involved with, the Air Force investigations, I think, I don't know how many people, before you came on, you know, the guy I do the news with, we were talking about this, is the importance of the history, and an example of the important history in this field is what the Air Force did, because they did undertake some important and well done under the supervision of Hynek, or the involvement, I guess, of Hynek in some cases, some investigation of some cases that were really interesting, where there was a little bit of, I guess, physical evidence that they were able to examine. And I know one of those cases that Hynek felt was important was Socorro.
Yes, it was. Socorro is quite an intriguing case, and Dr. Hynek absolutely, completely involved with that one.
Mm-hmm. And in Socorro, this was a police officer who saw a craft on the ground. There were a couple, he says, well, and this is debated whether or not he saw these two entities that entered the craft, and then the craft flew off. He saw the craft flying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just for those who aren't familiar with it, it was in April of 64 when a police officer was chasing a speeder and then saw something and heard something that made him break off the chase. That's fairly unusual for a police officer, because he thought it might be a plane crashing or something, you know, that was more important than just a speeder, or a dynamite shack in the area that might be exploding. And so he went over in that area where it was pretty sparsely populated at the time, and saw an egg-shaped object that was on the ground. You said there was some controversy about whether he also saw two humanoid-like figures outside of it. I'm convinced he did, but I'm not convinced he got much of a view of them in terms of detail. And then, oddly enough, after they essentially seemingly sighted him, you know, coming over the hill and getting out of his police car, they hopped back in this thing, which took off with a roar and a flame, and went up in the air, you know, not too far, and then kind of went parallel to the ground and went off in the distance. That doesn't sound like your typical disc-shaped UFO, because it's not. But there were landing marks there where the legs had been, and there was a soil that was burned, essentially, sand and so forth, and rocks. So unless you want to presume, which in fact a couple of skeptics did, that it was a hoax, something really landed there. And today, skeptics do not say that Lonnie Zamora, the policeman, you know, hoaxed it or made it up or misperceived something, you know, whatever, that was really mundane. You know, no, they say that something actually landed there. And the skeptics, and some people in the field, by the way, some of my colleagues even, say Lonnie saw some type of test device. Others of us, including me, say, yes, but there's no evidence of any test device as described, even though it resembled a little bit the lunar lander and a few other things. But there's just zero evidence of anything like that. And not that they're... couldn't be some program even today, maybe, that's hidden, you know, and all that, but it's been a lot of years, and there, you know, no vehicle like this has ever been developed since then, you know, what is that, 51 years, and so it doesn't seem likely to me that it was a test vehicle. On the other hand, of course, if it's a UFO, it's a darn strange one, even though some of them have been reported to do what this one did, even having flames. But that's part of the true mystery of the UFO subject. If every UFO that we saw was a 30-foot metallic disc, and they all made a humming noise, like on the day the Earth stood still, and et cetera, we would have something there, because we could go to the scientific community and say, hey, look, we've looked at 1,000 cases, in, you know, putting aside witness error. Every time they see it, it's this. So there has to be something that they're seeing. And I believe that would be irrefutable. One of the problems about the subject that's made it interesting but difficult to study is this incredible variety, which sometimes is down to, of course, poor witness you know, perception or reporting, also poor investigation. But really... fundamentally, I think most of the variation is caused by actual variation in the phenomena. Discs, triangles, you know, eggs that have flames at the bottom, cylinders. Again, I could go on for, you know, quite some time describing the variation here. And so that then, you know, circling back to Seth Shostak and many other skeptics, that leads skeptics to say it's implausible that a UFO phenomena, whatever it is, and of course everybody thinks, you know, aliens, would have those characteristics. Why would there be so much variety? You know, what's going on there? And so they use that to kind of superficially reject it.
Yeah, right. And that's why I bring up Socorro, because it was such an outlier, especially among those cases, because some of the more like the 1952 sightings, or these sightings that seemed very common in the Air Force records, which were balls of lights or lights seen in the night sky that perhaps were chased by jets and they weren't able to catch them. That was more common. These balls of light, similar to Hesdalen, which I want to talk about next. But the Socorro, I think that would be one where it's at least that one, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, you can see why people would attach that or speculate about that with that case.
Yeah, and of course, as we know, there are thousands of cases where, putting aside this issue of the variety, where if you agree that the witnesses are telling the truth and that they were, perceiving and reporting accurately, then it can't be, a terrestrial plane or missile or something. It can't be Venus. It can't be this. It can't be that. It can't be any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Then it means it's something really strange. And, if people see what seems to be an object flying around with incredible performance, naturally a very plausible and applicable and non-crazy theory is that it could be caused by extraterrestrials. It was a little more crazy before, by the way. We discovered all these exoplanets, and we learned so much more about our galaxy, about the evolution of stars, about the evolution of planetary systems, and about the evolution of life. All of those discoveries have convinced many scientists that intelligent life is likely to be fairly common in our galaxy.
Yeah.
Even though there's, the Fermi paradox and so forth.
Funny enough, in our headlines today, because we post, some of the headlines in mainstream news about UFOs or extraterrestrials, and there was a scientist making that argument in an opinion piece. I can't remember where he had written it, but it was one of the larger mainstream news outlets. And he talked about, sure, this star out there that's twinkling, it's not an alien, in his opinion, or that it's not aliens. However, we should probably stop snickering when we talk about these, people postulating about or speculating about aliens because of just what you're talking about. We're finding so many planets that it's not implausible or unscientific to speculate about that.
Right, and not only is it not, unscientific, certainly the people that I talk to, astronomers, physicists, are more likely, read their articles and so forth. The majority of them who pay attention, who study the issue, think that there is not only life out there, but there's intelligent life out there, which scientifically leaves only one barrier to thinking that the UFO phenomena is quite plausible as being caused by ET, and that barrier is getting here from there.
Mm-hmm.
Before these recent scientific discoveries and advancements, scientists could say not only can they not, travel from 100 light years or whatever, but they aren't even out there necessarily. They're very rare. So therefore, on both grounds, it's reasonable to reject the UFO phenomenon, maybe even reject studying it. Well, one of those grounds has been removed. And so what remains is, they can't get here from there.
Mm-hmm.
But that turns out also to have less force if you think about, all colonization, ET probes, and so forth, which scientists are writing about and have been for years. And so really the way I look at it is the theoretical objections to the UFO phenomena, the scientific objections pretty much have vanished. You can have the objections like, why do they see all these different kinds of UFOs, right? But that's not a scientific objection. That's a different kind.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. One of my favorite, I asked Michio Kaku about this once when I got to see him at a book signing and a little presentation he did, which was one of my favorite UFO presentations because he really was talking about all these possibilities and these different types of civilizations that could be out there. And I asked him, well, what about the theory, the SETI scientists talking about they can't get here? And he said, they're astronomers. What do they know about
that's
physics?
That's exactly right. And, a good old Stan Friedman says the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And I agree with Stan for once on that. So, absolutely. Also, some SETI scientists or SETI-related scientists, like Paul Davies, who some listeners may have heard that name, very well-known physicist who in his youth was interested in UFOs and even talked to Hynek a couple of times.
I didn't know that. I've interviewed him. I didn't know that.
Yeah, now I say youth to be kidding. He was very young scientist at the time in the 70s. Yep, he was interested in UFOs because Paul Davies has a great inquiring mind. I admire the guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very good scientist. Very broad-minded. He's even looked into cancer and things, even though he's trained in astronomy and physics. So, And so lately, he's talked about searching in the solar system, even on the moon, for ET artifacts.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you're as close as the moon, I'd say, why don't we just step a little bit closer and look, you know, look here on Earth.
Just right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So, Hestelin. And Hestelin now is a phenomenon in Norway in the Hestelin Valley, right? And what's exciting about this, and this is where I'm really excited about the UFO Data Project too, is that there have been universities in Norway that have been observing this UFO phenomena, for lack of a better term, of these balls of light that are seen in this valley. Now, this may be more akin to ball lightning, but maybe you could speak to this case and what some of the theories are there and some of the research or observing that they've done.
Yes, the Hestelin phenomena, which of course was seen by locals for years, but it came to the attention of the UFO community around 1980. That's as good a time as any to, you know, demarcate it. Is, as you said, mostly balls of light. Not always. Some people see structured objects, but the vast, vast majority are balls of light that, in fact, you know, hover over the ground and don't land or anything, and no humanoids and so forth. But absolutely, they're being seen. They've been photographed. They've been seen by researchers, you know, at the scene, because many, many scientists have gone there. You, of course, some from Norway have gone, but there's a group of Italian scientists that have been going there for years, and one of them is on our team, Massimo Teodorani, for UFO Data. Even a group from France has gone there recently. It's kind of interesting, in fact, that Hestelin, so the phenomenon is absolutely established, real. You know, the scientific community is still not paying a lot of attention to it, but this is I'll get back to the phenomenon in a second and what might be causing it, but, you know, Alejandro, this is a good example of how science, you know, actually functions and the incentive structure in science. So, okay, there's a real phenomena, definitely mysterious, you know, these balls of light. But then you say to yourself, okay, well, who should be studying that, right, in, you know, in the scientific community? And then what's their incentive? What do they think they're going to get out of studying it, right? You know, in other words, will it what new knowledge will it give us? And it turns out that, of course, we knock out all the social sciences, you know, we knock out the historians, you know, we get down to, we knock out the astronomers, the chemists, the biologists, they're not going to study it. It's atmospheric physicists, maybe geologists, possibly, and people like that that would be interested in this phenomena. And then you have to say, okay, well, are they going to study it? Well, you know, maybe if you're a scientist in the U.S. or China or someplace, you say, no, I got to get over there. I'm not sure I'm going to get a grant for this. And, you know, people have talked about it being UFOs, too. And so basically they're not going to go out of their way. In fact, no scientists that I know of, except for Alan Hynek, have gone to Hestelin to look into it seriously. Alan went there very early, back in the early 80s when it first came up. So you end up, well, it must be scientists in Europe where they're closer to it, and that's what it is, as you mentioned and as I described. But even then, there's only a few, because it's a remote valley. You can't get a lot of funding. It's not easy to do. They don't appear all the time. And so what you see is this phenomena that you and I and many others find fascinating, and is essentially UFO sightings, but yes, I don't think it's extraterrestrial necessarily, is also hard to study, not really incentivized well by the way science is structured to make it easy to study. And so the scientific teams have only made intermittent progress, but they have made progress. They've even taken spectra of the lights, and certainly showed that, you know, it's an ionized ball of gas, as you would expect. They detected some metals there that may be actually traces of ground, elements that are in the ground there that are a little unusual in that area. And I should say they're unusual in soil in general. They're in that area, stated correctly. And so it appears that there may be dust particles that are up in the, like lifted up in the air, that are incorporated into this plasma. Finally, it's a long answer here, is that... you know, this is one of the mysteries about Earth lights in general, like during earthquakes and so forth, is how do these lights form exactly? You know, we know there's energies involved, at least during earthquakes, there's huge energies involved. We can think of friction there might ionize the air, have strong electric and magnetic fields. In Hessthalen, you know, there aren't earthquakes. There's nothing particularly happening when somebody sees a light. So it's a quite of a mystery as to how this energy gets concentrated in this ball, which lasts much longer than ball lightning.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what they've done, and this kind of then brings us to UFO data, is that they have set up stations out there to observe this phenomena and to collect a lot of different sorts of data, which then is kind of, and it's probably why you have these guys part of the team, plus they're open to the UFO mm-hmm. phenomena. It turned out this Italian gentleman, I forget his name, he follows our website. He's on our email list. It was funny. We sent out an email the other day, and I saw he was on our list, which is so exciting. But that this is similar to what you all are going to begin to do with UFO data.
Yes, exactly. As you noted, there's something called the Blue Box at Hessthalen, which Erling Strand, the lead scientist there, has set up. You know, it's in the field continuously, you know, taking photos on a regular basis and making a few other measurements. But at UFO Data, I've been thinking for years, and I'm not unique in this, and people for years have realized that, like any scientific phenomena, you know, or rather, you know, phenomena you want to study scientifically, we need to get real-time measurements of it. So if you want to understand meteors, you know, yeah, you can get them when they land, and that's good, actually, because then, you can pick them up and study them, but you also can study them in the atmosphere and as they streak through the sky and learn things that way. And if you want to study all, you know, just name the phenomena, you know, you have to study in real time. You know, you could, lightning maybe is a better example. So how do we learn about lightning? Well, we could ask people what lightning bolts look like, and we can, you know, how long did it last and what color it was, but no, it's much better to go out, of course, and measure about lightning bolts when they're happening. So we want to do the same thing with UFOs, even though it's quite a challenge. So we want to develop automated stations, so, you know, somebody doesn't have to be there manning the station 24 hours a day, that are hooked up to the Internet and that have a set of instruments, of course, cameras, a magnetometer, and cameras with a spectrograph attached, so we can take a spectrum of a UFO that shows up there, of other possible instruments, of course, a weather station to get that, and be able to, you know, in real time, measure things about a UFO systematically and reliably, so we don't have to rely on the anecdotal evidence that you mentioned before that has been, you know, the vast, vast, vast majority of UFO data so far.
Mm-hmm. And how large are these stations going to be?
You know, not really large. You know, bigger than a bread box, but, you know, smaller than a pickup truck, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, we're still in the design phase. But everything is miniaturized these days, mm-hmm. and I would guess that the actual container for the instruments will be the biggest thing, right? Because they have to be protected from the weather mm-hmm. and lifted off the ground a little bit. But, you know, cameras are small, magnetometers are extremely small, and everything is pretty small. Of course, there'll have to be a electronics board, the equivalent of a PC in there, and a communications device, and the equivalent of a hard drive and, you know, all of that. But, you know, even if as I mentioned those things, you know, you can see that it's not going to be huge. Mm-hmm. If the power, because eventually solar would be good to use, but we'll see if that's, you know, it won't work in all areas. But they won't be gigantic in size, but they will be bigger than a bread box. Mm-hmm. And they won't be portable on wheels or anything. They'll be the kind of thing you can disassemble and move. But, you know, once it's in place, you'll want to leave it for quite some time, because we know that unfortunately for us, UFOs don't appear on schedule. They don't necessarily appear. You know, in Hessthalen, they appear regularly, if you use that word loosely, but you can't predict when they're going to appear. So mm-hmm. you have to sit there and wait for months at a time. And so we understand this is not going to be easy. But we also know that if you don't try, you're definitely not going to succeed.
Right. So we've had Mark D'Antonio on quite a few times, and we were able to be lucky enough to have mm-hmm. the special effects guru, Doug Trumbull, who, funny enough, when he was on, I asked him a few questions about Dr. Hynek because of their
movie.
Yeah, both affiliated with Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he said he is a fan, but he wasn't able to talk to him. But they're doing a similar project called UFOTOG. They've got at least a because this is what they do, a model mock-up of this thing that looks like a UFO, and I've posted pictures on the Facebook. I think they have too. So it's kind of a similar thing, although it sounds like you all are looking at – you're using more of Hesdalen as a model, and it sounds like you're planning on perhaps using a bit more equipment.
I think we are. I have, of course, been following the UFOTOG progress, and even though they don't say too much publicly, but they do now and then. Like, I think Mark gave a lecture recently at MUFON's mm-hmm. annual symposium about it. First of all, as the what was it, the Chinese that said, "Let a thousand flowers bloom." we're quite happy that other people are working on projects like this, because you know, the more devices that are out there trying to get UFO data, the better. And also complementary, because maybe we're going to take the wrong approach. And so I don't think so. None of us do. But you want to have diversity in your scientific instrumentation, because you don't really know which one's going to be best. But as we understand it, yes, we want to build a little more robust suite of instruments, which will be more expensive per station than what they're doing, which is to focus on just a few things and maybe have a few more stations there for. And, you know, so you can see the little different philosophies. We took ours because, and of course, there have been field studies before, not just Hesdalen, but other places that were very intermittent. Yakima, Washington, and Dave Akers, a name that people probably don't know. He's also one of our consulting scientists on the team, and Dave was one of the early pioneers in field studies at the Yakima Indian Reservation in Washington State, and took photos of glowing balls of light there and other things. So, but we think that you need enough instrumentation to measure enough, you know, characteristics reliably of a UFO to begin to figure out what kind of energies are involved, and so forth. If you just take a good photo of a UFO, let's imagine we had stations that just took photos. Yeah, you could show that it's real, of course, and all that, but you wouldn't get enough evidence that it was unusual enough to probably convince the scientific community, because they are so adamant and adamantly opposed mm-hmm. To the UFO subject. So you need data that says, hey, wait a minute, not only do we have a photo that shows, yeah, this was real, and here it is, here's the photo, but we took a spectrum, and that this thing had these characteristics, and look mm-hmm. how strange these characteristics are. You know, they don't match anything that we would expect. Okay, well, now you've got something.
Mm-hmm. So. And that's what I was thinking when you were talking about the meteorites and stuff like that, and you know, some things that people might not think of, and why that is valuable data is, for instance, if you know the type of equipment you're recording this on, and you've got the right equipment to get the right data, then, for instance, the color of the object can tell you a lot.
Yes. Again, the color turns out it can. And then when you take the spectra, you essentially take that color and break it up, you know, in all these different bands. But the magnetic field isn't one, and, you know, a gravitometer, is there any effect on local gravity? Mm-hmm. Is there an electric, you know, is there a change in radio frequency, microwave radiation, right? The whole spectrum of radiation is what, you know, we'd like to measure within reason and cost to see, because people have certainly measured things in UFOs where they were emitting the equivalent of microwaves or whatever, or the light was polarized. There's a famous UFO case where a guy happened to be wearing polarized sunglasses. Mm-hmm. And the UFO looked different depending on whether he was or was not wearing his sunglasses, mm-hmm. which means the light from the UFO was polarized, and which means it's rotating as it comes towards you. And not all light does, and that could tell you something about the UFO in combination with other measurements. So, you know, absolutely, we are, because the evidence has been so anecdotal, it's demonstrated to me, you know, 100% certainty that it's real, and a few other details, but it hasn't penetrated at the core of what the phenomena might be. And, you know, who knows? If these are the really interesting UFO sightings, our alien spacecraft, it still may be difficult to figure out much more than, well, they've got this strange, you know, glowing plasma around them, right? And it's at this temperature and, you know, and all the rest. I mean, there's no guarantee that we're going to be able to, you know, penetrate to say, well, it looks like they're using a warp 2 drive, you know. but like I said before, you know, before I get to be too old, and I'm old enough now, I'd like to see us, you know, try to advance UFO research, you know, beyond where we are today.
Mm-hmm. And you've got an impressive team with a lot of expertise. Like, for instance, what is your background and the background of some of the other scientists?
I have a background that's worked out very well for me because I have a bachelor's degree in astrophysics and some graduate school, and then I switched and got a PhD in sociology.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate both sides of the coin social and physical sciences. But we have the people on the team, the lead scientists are either people like Massimo Teodorani from Italy, Dave Akers, Eamon Ansbrough from Ireland, who have done field research on UFOs, like we've been describing, just not, you know, with many stations. Or they're Ron Masters, who, like I, happens to live in the Chicago area, a PhD chemist who has developed a really unique spectrograph for us to use for the stations that is going to let you at the same time take a high-quality photo and get a high-quality spectrum in the same image, which turns out not to be necessarily easy to do. And then we have other supporting scientists from, you know, a variety of areas and some engineers and all that. And, by the way, we launched the project less than 2 weeks ago publicly. We've already had over 50 people volunteer to help.
Wow.
Not all of them technical, but that's fine. Not everybody, you know, has that expertise, and maybe others can help us with PR and so forth and organizational activities. But many technically oriented and qualified people have come forward, and we have almost an embarrassment of riches that we're trying to sort through. So we expect to have given that everybody's going to have to be a volunteer, a very strong team that we can assemble, you know, to work on this project. And so also I should add that nothing we're proposing is difficult. You know, difficult is building a probe to go to Pluto, you know, last in space for all those years, and then, you know, do its work flawlessly to study Pluto as it flies by at a high speed. Building these stations is not, you know, reinventing the wheel, with one exception I'll mention in a second. And so it's comes down to having the expertise and then the funding. The one exception is that people, except possibly for the Defense Department, have not had to develop software that is really good and very, very efficient at looking at images and sorting out what is, let's call, natural, right, from mm-hmm. something that's not natural. Because we can't be recording everything that appears in front of the lenses, because, you know, everything appears in front of the lenses, insects, birds, strange clouds, planes that fly over, right? You can just go on and on and on. So we need more that will let us sort that stuff out and focus on the more interesting detections. Mm-hmm. And there are programs that do this, but they are not up to the challenge of a project of this scope, we've learned. Mm. And so that's going to be one area of development for us.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, there's a lot of smart guys in the software area right now, so hopefully that'll be something that'll be able to happen.
It can happen. People are very smart, like you say. They're very creative. Of course, it can be done. You know, we just have to find the right people and talent, and we'll make it happen.
Now you talk about volunteers and some of your consulting scientists, and I think it's really interesting to see that the stigma around the phenomena still has its effect, and you have quite a few under the category of I think it's even secret.
Silent advisors,
right,
we're calling them.
Silent, where they don't want their names or their affiliations. I think they're mostly all academics, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't want that information known.
Right. I mean, these are all, obviously, I can't tell you who they are, even what country they're in, but they're all good, qualified people. They're absolutely committed to the subject. But they just feel like, because of where they're at in their career, that they cannot openly, forget actually going out like and working, hard on the team. They don't even want to sign their name, essentially, and say, yeah, this project should go forward. And isn't that sad that
yeah.
in 2015 that they can't even just say, hey, this project is reasonable? These people are not crazy, because none of us are, maybe me, but the rest of them are not. These people are all professionals. They're going to do this in a straightforward fashion, so I support their effort. And, these folks don't think they can do that openly.
Yeah, so unfortunate. I mean, it was a little bit shocking to me. Robert Powell, who I had on last week.
Sure,
but
great guy.
Yep, he's part of your group, they did that research on the Puerto Rico sighting, and I've been able to converse with this expert on that system, and that was used to record that object, and him and his colleagues are really into it. They've been looking at the video. They've been so helpful. But they don't want their names to be revealed or associated with that work either, because of fear of, reprisals and of course they don't, and it shows, the importance. They don't want to risk, their credentials or their clearances.
Right. I mean, years ago at the center, we received an email, and I called the guy, editor at a major national newspaper, I will leave it at that, who said, I want to tell you about a UFO sighting in my neighborhood, in my backyard.
Hmm.
I cannot talk to my colleagues. I can't even mention this to my colleagues, because they'll think I've gone off the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
They'll shun me. It's as bad as being Republican. In some circles in Washington, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't say that, but that's my. But essentially, that, because major national newspapers, this is not me being pejorative. We know from surveys that most of the reporters are liberal, and so it would be like coming out and saying you're a conservative there at many of these papers. He felt that, except it would be worse. Essentially, it would be worse. Beyond the pale.
Uh-huh.
And so he told me his sighting. It was a great sighting. It was at dusk, and saw a triangle object, very small. Not all triangles are 300 or 500 feet across, that was silently moving through their neighborhood. His neighbor was outside. She saw it too, and they compared notes afterwards. They saw exactly the same thing. And then they both agreed to tell only their spouse about it, and that was it. He just felt he wanted to report it and talk to somebody about it. And see if other people had seen things that were similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we did that, and then he said, great, but, not only can you not use my name or publish this, but, I'm still not going to talk to anybody about it. Well, there you go. He had a sighting that was, as clear as day. These days, it was like seeing a drone come over, except it was long enough ago that it wasn't a drone and it was too large to be a drone. But it's like today, if somebody sees something now and they say, hey, I saw a drone in my neighborhood, what's the first reaction? They believe it.
Right.
Because we know drones are real. That's fine. They are real. And people are flying them all over, and often illegally, or at least the FAA would like them to be illegal. And so if somebody says, hey, I saw a weird drone of my backyard, you and I wouldn't think, oh, man, you know, what's Joe been drinking?
This guy's,
you know,
off his rocker.
You would say, okay, what did it look like, Joe? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read about these drone things, right?
Yeah.
But if Joe says, hey, I saw, same Joe, same everything, same distance from Joe, right? Everything's the same. But he says, hey, I saw a 20-foot, you know, dark boomerang come over my house. First reaction is, hey, what have you been drinking, Joe?
Yeah. Or even more sad, his worst fear is maybe Joe needs to move on and not work with us anymore.
Yeah, well, of course, that's the worst fear, as with the scientists and others, the video guys that you mentioned. Right, that's the fear, is that their job is in jeopardy. And, of course, I completely understand it. Families and all the rest and careers, mm-hmm. You can't put your job in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully that will change. And you know, what are your comments like that opinion piece that that scientist, he's saying, oh, you know, this whole news about this alien star, that's not aliens, but we should quit making fun of aliens. Do you think it's changing? And do you think that if we were, and hopefully it seems like we're on the cusp, but if we were to even find an extraterrestrial microbe on Mars, do you think that'll help change people's perception?
I don't think a microbe on Mars would, even as exciting as it wouldn't and should be, I don't think it would necessarily change people's perceptions about the UFO phenomena. Of course, it would change the perceptions about the likelihood of life elsewhere. But there would still be that problem of how do they get here from there, because, sure, Mars is there, but it's only a microbe, and how are they going to get here from Alpha Centauri or something?
Mm-hmm.
So it would take more than that. However, if SETI detects if some of the SETI projects do detect life out there, an intelligence, whatever that means, whether it's beam radio waves or light or indirect evidence, surely will make it easier to argue for the UFO case.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means, yes, there really is, at least, you know, when nobody's speculating anymore, you know, aliens do exist.
Mm-hmm.
But again, not much more, because the barrier against UFOs, as it is against parapsychology, the other, you know, big anomaly in science that is shunned by the establishment, and yet for which I believe there's a tremendous amount of evidence, even though I don't, you know, I'm hardly... You know, I'm not a professional parapsychologist and don't even play one at home. the barriers against them are huge. They developed over many years. They are, you know, almost ossified. And so you still have today, people having to our silent advisors hide their identities or their support for something. And so I don't see that changing without getting more definitive evidence for the subject. And parapsychology has the evidence in droves, and the rejection there is, you know, that's again another podcast. But in UFOs, it really would only take a few sightings in a way. You can imagine the classic, not just the White House lawn, but, you know, if a disc covers over the next Super Bowl game and just sits there for 30 minutes, doesn't land, doesn't do anything, just sits there for 30 minutes, and then flies away, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a whole new ballgame. I'm not saying that's not going to happen. But it will show you that, unlike in parapsychology, which has to rely on statistical regularities and experiments, and they're very strong and powerful ones that have been done, in UFOs we have, you know, sightings one at a time. Maybe we have one witness, maybe we have thousands of witnesses, but they're one at a time. So a one or two sightings could tip things over if they were, you know, evidential enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, funny thing is, having talked about politics, something happens at the White House and no matter what it is, people are going to be skeptical. But if it happens at the Super Bowl, now you're talking when everybody's watching.
Well, yeah.
So next steps. So I know So you're looking to get some money to build a prototype, and then you're going to look to crowdfunding. Is that correct?
Right. Phase one, our website, got to get that out, is ufodata.net. Mm-hmm. Ufodata.net, just like it sounds, describes the project and has a form to fill out if you want to volunteer your talents, skills, and so forth, and does have a donate button. But phase one is not the crowdfunding phase as such. We are getting together volunteers. We're going to be finishing then the design of our prototype station and building it, testing it, which, you know, it's not a simple process, and therefore demonstrating that we can do this. And then we go to crowdfunding, where we say to our assembled masses, and they are out there. We both know how much great interest there is in UFOs. Mm-hmm. And so we say to them, hey, look, we are not just, you know, we're not just talking. We're doing it, you know, we're walking. And we actually can do this thing. And here's what it looks like. Here's what it's going to do. So, yes, would you give us X amount of dollars so we can build more of these and start doing real science?
Mm-hmm. And Leslie and her story, Leslie Kane, who essentially announced this project with her Huffington Post blog a couple weeks ago and also part of your team, wrote a lot about this Russian billionaire who is giving $100 million to the SETI guys, where if he could funnel just a little bit of that over to you guys, you could do a lot with it.
Yes. Yes, we certainly could. We don't need $100 million, not that we're going to get it ever, but we don't need it, mm-hmm. that much money to do the project that I've described and do it, you know, I think reasonably well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess timelines, do you have any goals for, you know, what you hope to have achieved when?
Well, we have to be realistic because we are, as I mentioned, the challenge of the software and working with these volunteers who literally are scattered, you know, not just in the States but around the world. And so it is going to take quite some time, you know, mm-hmm. maybe a year, let's say, to get to the crowdfunding phase, if not longer. You know, we don't want to overpromise, I'm not exactly guessing, but I'm only, you know, it's just an educated best judgment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least that long is my current judgment to get to the crowdfunding phase. And then, of course, after that, you know, comes more testing and all that. So it's not going to be soon. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be soon enough, I think, that people can stay excited. But it's not going to be like, okay, 2 months from now we'll have a prototype, and then 4 months later we'll start, you know, they're going to be all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
I know that UFOTOG has had a long development period with Doug Trumbull and Mark D'Antonio and their team. You know, ours, we've already done some work, you know, we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll be definitely keeping a close eye on that and updating people on your progress. And I guess, really, okay, now my last question would be, for the prototype, are you planning on putting it at, placing it in a hot spot, you know, a UFO hot spot, so to speak, or are you thinking more about a convenient proximity to people who can do some maintenance on it?
It has to, number one, it has to be close to the, you know, the testing, maintenance, and so forth. That said, yes, if we can also put it in a UFO hot spot, that would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been thinking about that. It is going to depend slightly on. We have some team members that might be able to host that first station, but you know, we've already had three people talk to us and already about, hey, I will host a station, you know, in my mm-hmm. fairly isolated spot, not necessarily a hot spot, but just a good spot where the station will be secure and so forth. So we'll be balancing those factors, but certainly, if the prototype station is not in the UFO hotspot, naturally the first working stations, you know, would go in those places.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a ton of fun for me. This has been really interesting, and we'll definitely look forward to progress.
Thanks. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much to Mark Rodiger for joining us on the show. That was a ton of fun. I thought it would be, and it was. What a really great guy with a lot of history. And I'm so excited about this UFO data thing. Of course, I've had Mark on quite a bit to talk about UFO talk because I'm all excited about that. And I know you are all as well because I often get contacts from you all saying, hey, what's going on with that thing? And, you know, I talk to Mark about it occasionally. I talk to him at the symposium, MUFON symposium. And they're working on it, and they think they might have some funding. And I know they're talking with Mark's group and UFO data. So this is really cool, bringing, you know, ufology to the next step. But so many interesting topics. There's just so much interesting about this field. That's why it's so fun to talk about and so interesting. But we definitely are rooting for Mark and the group. And, of course, if you feel that you have something to offer, whether that be money or time or anything else, UFOData.net, like he said, is where you can go to get in contact with the group and help them out. And I encourage anyone, if you're interested in this, and I'm sure I know many of you are, you know, talk to them and see what you can do. So hopefully we could get this thing rolling. And if you haven't gone to their website, definitely do. It's a great website. It has a lot of information about their project and what they're planning to do. And you can look at their list of consulting scientists, the people that are part of their board. And it's just a very, very impressive list of people, which also makes it exciting. Often, you know, people will say, oh, scientists aren't into UFOs. Well, if you go look at this list, you'll see that just this list alone demonstrates that certainly there are many scientists that are interested. There's just maybe not just a scientific organization like a university that's involved. But that's why I've always been so excited about the Hesdalen Project, because that is are some universities out in Norway that are actually looking at a UFO phenomena and observing it and studying it. In fact, on my story about UFO data on openminds.tv, I've got a video that is was captured by those scientific researchers, and I've also got links to their website where they have more videos about lights that they've captured out there in Hesdalen, many of which you can download. They're downloadable, so you can save them to your computer and look them over, and maybe you will discover the mystery behind the Hesdalen lights. Really exciting. Another exciting list of people, including many PhDs, into the topic of UFOs or aliens, is the list of speakers at the UFO Congress. Huh, nice segue, huh? Yeah, this is really cool. I could just have been working on that list. I cleaned it up. I've added some information to the UFO Congress speaker list. I've also added more lectures, because people have sent us more lecture information. So perhaps you saw a speaker up there that was really neat, but you didn't know what they were going to be talking about because the lecture section is TBD. Well, it is TBD no longer because I've filled in some more information. So check that out. Also, Robert Powell, who we had on last week, who hopefully you guys love him as much as I do. I think he's a great last week was a great interview too, just like this week. And he is going to be speaking about the Puerto Rico case. So that's going to be a lot of fun to hear more about that from him at the conference, because I know they've done some animations and some other really cool things. And you'll get to know about the latest with the Puerto Rico case in February. So just a lot of exciting stuff going on. So check that out. The other thing is we have a lot of information, some about this UFO data and others, on our UFO report, including, you know, Jeremy Corbell and asking some questions of a panel of CIA guys who are talking about Area 51. And, you know, this panel being moderated by George Knapp, the KLAS investigative journalist out of Las Vegas. So this is really cool stuff too. So just a whole lot of cool stuff going down, people. And you can find it all at openminds.tv. You know who else is really cool Oh, I should mention anybody who, you know, who's cool, anybody who's wearing an Open Minds t-shirt. And that's because the Open Minds t-shirts are so cool. And you can go to openminds.tv and hit on the store to see our new t-shirts. They're awesome. What else is cool and who else is cool are the people who are discussing in our Facebook group. So I told you guys about how we have a new Facebook group where there's lots of cool discussions going on because we have these administrators who are awesome. They used to do a MUFON Facebook group. That group got closed, and so they've moved over, and they're really cool people. But it's troll-free. How cool is this? You can go into our Facebook group, talk about UFOs and UFO sightings, post your own sighting, get some feedback without, you know, that crazy goofiness that goes on in the internet. Just smart, intelligent debate and talk about these topics with everybody being respectful of one another, which is the way it should be. So check out our Facebook group. And what else is cool? Martin Willis is cool, who joined us at the beginning of the show. Check out his UFO podcast. And who's really cool is Caleb Hanks. Many of you know Micah Hanks. I was on his show not too long ago of Graylian. This is his brother, Caleb Hanks. They're both cool guys. And Caleb, of course, does the opening music and the closed music for us. I want to thank him so much. You can find a link to his music at the Clerk Chronicles on our radio page at openminds.tv. And finally, I want to thank the coolest of all the cool, and that is you. You are one cool cat because you're listening to this show and you're just a cool dude in my book. So thank you all so much for listening. You guys have a great week. We'll talk to you again next week. I've got a surprise for you next week. So this is going to be really great. Otherwise, you guys have a great week and adios, muchachos.